Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we've invited some special guests onto our show, the producers of a podcast called Gravy by the Southern Foodways Alliance. We'll travel with them to explore stories and the roots of some Southern food. We'll visit a historic salt mine in West Virginia that's being revived.
What happened here is so remarkable, so unusual, that it's a story that just can't be lost for the ages.
Chefs across the country are falling in love with this Appalachian salt. And we'll head over to a fried chicken festival in Virginia.
We take the chicken straight out of the pack, batter it, put it in the fryer.
Okay.
We put all our secret spices. As you see, I think people are enjoying it.
Yeah, you got a line.
That's a good thing.
We'll also be talking to a food historian about how fried chicken is connected to our complicated history of race and racism.
Here's this food that is, first of all, eaten with the hands, right? And so right away, there's this notion of savagery, of less than refinement. Now it's like, look at these barbarians, you know?
I hope you'll stick with us as once again, we feed your appetite for stories about Appalachian food. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. So, if you're an avid follower of our program, you might have noticed that one thing we just love here on Inside Appalachia is food. We even started a new segment last fall called Appetite Appalachia, which features restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots. Across the coal fields, more and more grocery stores are disappearing. McDowell County, West Virginia just lost their Walmart, and people really don't have a lot of options if they want to buy fresh food. It's part of the reason why so many people in Appalachia get their food at gas stations, a lot of hot dogs, chips, and Slim Jims. And don't get me wrong, that's Appalachian food too. I'm not denying that hearing about those things makes me want to grab a big old pepperoni roll with cheese and a side of Fritos from the gas station. Oh, and some fried chicken. But it's nice to have options. We'll have that fried chicken a little later in the show. But what is Appalachian cuisine? Is it just Tudor's biscuits and hot dogs? There's an older kind of cooking that's not quite as popular here in rural Appalachia and across the South, the simple comfort food our grandparents ate. Oddly enough, it's these foods that are starting to get more popular in urban areas across the country. Everything from gravy to grits to ramps to beans and cornbread, these dishes seem to keep appearing in restaurants, at least in cities like New York, Richmond, and Louisville. But right here in coal country, well, there are some chefs that are re-exploring their Appalachian roots. Not a lot, but the number is growing. Last year, a group of chefs, farmers, and food writers gathered at the annual Appalachian Food Summit in Abington, Virginia. Our producer, Roxy Todd, was there, and we'll be hearing more from her visit later next month. But while she was there, she met an oral historian who introduced her to a new podcast that we love. Roxy, tell us more about what you found while you were at the Appalachian Food Summit in Virginia.
So yeah, a bunch of us were gathered in this restaurant over dinner, and there I met this woman named Sarah Wood. She works for the Southern Foodways Alliance, and she collects oral histories about food, and she helps collect stories about preserving the traditional ways of cooking Southern food. And she also introduced me to this great podcast called Gravy, which tells the stories of a changing Appalachian South through the foods that we all eat. And on their website, the show is described as one that showcases a South that is constantly evolving, accommodating new immigrants, adopting new traditions, and lovingly maintaining old ones. The podcast producers are hoping to give voice to the unsung folk who grow, cook, and serve our daily meals. So I listened to a few of the episodes from Gravy, and I'm really excited about these stories.
Yeah, I think the podcast tackles some tough topics in a really smart way with food. We also think it's important to cover stories about food, especially with the rise in food deserts in the region. Hence the reason for our own Appetite Appalachia segment.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table, eating beans and making love as long as I am able.
It's a segment on our show that explores the restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots. For this week's episode, we found the stories from the Gravy podcast. We'll start with a story about Appalachian salt. West Virginia is known for its wealth of resources: coal, natural gas, oil, and timber. But before any of those became king, another industry boomed here during the 1800s, salt. The heart of salt production lay in a small town on the Appalachians' western slope, where, believe it or not, an ocean once covered everything in sight. But salt was an industry built on the backs of slaves, and one that proved destructive to the region's environment. Now, a seventh-generation salt-making family is reviving the business. For this first story, produced by the Southern Foodways Alliance's Gravy Podcast, Caleb Johnson brings us the story of two siblings who are reckoning with their family's past and making salt.
You can see fog on the slopes of the Green Mountains beyond the Dickinson family farm outside Charleston, West Virginia, but the sun hangs high, which means it's a good day for salt making. Salt can be mined, or it can be evaporated from brine, which is what happens here using only the sun. Lewis Payne enters a long rectangular building that looks like a greenhouse, but inside stand raised wooden beds lined with black tarp and filled with salty water.
The bed we're looking at here is probably ready to harvest because there's crystals on the entire length of it.
Lewis is one of the owners of J.Q. Dickinson Salt Works in Malden. It's not yet 9 a.m. and already muggy here in what he calls the Sunhouse. He's out here with his sister and co-owner of the salt works, Nancy Bruns. They're the seventh generation in their family to do this kind of work. Nancy drags a cherry wood rake along the bottom of the bed. With clear skies, it takes at best 5 weeks for the brine to evaporate enough to harvest salt. As Nancy rakes, big crystals pile up where Lewis stands waiting.
And so I've got a small scraper or paddle, and I'm paddling it into a large wooden scoop, the crystals, and then I'll let it drip off a bit, and then I'll scoop the salt into the towel.
Lewis ties the towel and hangs it on a metal hook. The bundle looks like what cartoon storks use to deliver babies. A train passes in the distance, but it's quiet in the J.Q. Dickinson Sunhouse, except for the sack of salt dripping dry. Maybe you've heard of harvesting salt from an ocean, but West Virginia is a landlocked state. So where exactly do Nancy and Lewis get the brine to fill their sunhouses? Get this. The siblings say their brine comes from an ancient body of water trapped far below Malden. It's called the Iapetus Ocean. Turns out, it's every bit as mysterious as it sounds.
You know, oceans are kind of slippery things.
That's Charlie Jones.
I'm a lecturer at the University of Pittsburgh in the Department of Geology and Planetary Science.
I meet Charlie one evening in his fifth floor office. Every flat surface is covered with rocks, fossils, books about rocks and fossils, drill bits, and souvenirs from his fieldwork days. Nothing is labeled. It's like his office serves as an overflow space for the local Natural History Museum. Charlie pulls up a bunch of maps on a large computer monitor and starts going through them. Millions of years pass with every click. Tectonic plates shift continents around the globe, and as a result, oceans form between the new landmasses.
So look at that. So here's the Iapetus, here they call the Iapetus Ocean there. So there was a big supercontinent of Gondwana, and North America was part of a smaller continent called Laurentia. And the Iapetus then is whatever is between Laurentia and Gondwana.
Charlie's describing a map of Earth 470 million years ago. Scientists name these continents and oceans after Greek gods and places in ancient legends, and Charlie clearly relishes saying them aloud.
Iapetus is really this little sliver in here, and Noreika is on the other side of this little sliver of land called Avalonia, you know, where King Arthur was put out to sea. I guess he went there, I don't know.
The Iapetus Ocean teemed with life. Trilobites, sharks, and giant armored fish were among the many species. But on land, much less was going on. There weren't even any plants, just algae and fungi. As sea levels changed, the Iapetus sometimes washed over parts of what we now call North America, including where Malden, West Virginia now sits, more than 400 miles inland from the Atlantic Ocean.
The water is a little bit deeper and surrounded by all sorts of coral reefs. And the reefs made it hard for the seawater to freely circulate, to wash in and out. And it turned out that these reefs were in subtropical latitudes, and in the modern Earth, the subtropics are where you have the highest rates of evaporation, where the deserts are.
And as the water evaporated, just like the brine in Nancy and Lewis's sunhouses, salt crystals were left behind. As more time passed, more ocean water washed in, and then that water evaporated too, leaving behind even more salt. Salt upon salt upon salt. Eventually, it was all covered up by sediment, and today, what's left of the Iapetus Ocean is a layer of salt buried deep underground.
So it's the salts from the Iapetus Sea, but not the water from the Iapetus Sea.
But Nancy and Lewis are pumping up something wet, right? Charlie says this brine is actually the result of groundwater percolating into the ancient layer of Iapetus Ocean salt. This water dissolves the salt it touches, and eventually, somehow, from pressure gradients and other geologic mysteries, the salty water works its way back up through layer after layer of earth and into shallower sandstone. Some of the brine even makes it all the way to the surface. Hundreds of years ago, buffalo and other animals visited a boggy salt lick in the Kanawha Valley. Native Americans followed the animals there. White people followed them, and large-scale salt production began in the early 1800s and quickly ramped up.
Malden would have been an industrial town. It was brawly. It was dangerous. I'm sure Saturday night was a pretty rough place.
That's Larry Rowe, a local historian. He talks about people from the past as if you could still spot them walking Malden's sleepy main street. Larry says by 1817, when Nancy and Lewis's family drilled its first well using hollow tree trunks as piping, over 50 salt furnaces were already burning along the Kanawha River. The furnaces were fed wood and later coal to evaporate brine out of large iron kettles, leaving behind a rosy pink salt. Workers piled this salt on barges headed to Cincinnati, a major pork hub back then.
You can guess over 50 salt furnaces using a fuel source every day, that the air would have been really, really bad here. The work was fairly dangerous, and when we compare slavery, agricultural slavery in eastern Virginia, it would have been much better work.
Historians debate this last point. The density of Malden at the time certainly made for a different kind of slavery, though the inhumane foundation was the same. The Kanawha Valley salt industry was built on the backs of thousands of slaves, some of them leased from farms across state lines. Salt production peaked in 1846. 5 years later, the Dickinson's Kanawha salt was deemed best salt in the world at the World's Fair in London. The Dickinson's counted 500 workers, including slaves, and produced 8,000 pounds of salt per day. For some context on scale, Nancy and Lewis hoped to produce that much salt this year.
By the Civil War, the furnaces were really very large factory-looking buildings.
But booms are always followed by busts. The Kanawha Valley salt makers produced too much salt and prices fell. New railroad lines also made it easier to get salt from other places. One by one, furnaces in the Kanawha Valley went dark. By the second half of the 1800s, the Dickinson Salt Works were one of the last left operating. They made salt until 1945, and when they finally stopped, that was it for salt in the Kanawha Valley.
Malden now is a pastoral village. It's a wonderful place to live and raise kids.
Growing up in this area, Nancy and Lewis weren't aware of their family's role in the Kanawha Valley salt industry. Other family-owned ventures, a bank, leasing land for coal mining and natural gas extraction, overshadowed the story of salt. It wasn't until a few years ago when Nancy's husband Carter started a master's program in American history. He came across some familiar names in his research, and Nancy got curious.
I started seeing our family in a very different way. I knew we made salt, I just didn't know the extent of the history of it.
History grabbed Nancy and wouldn't let her go. She and Carter were living in North Carolina at the time, where they'd owned a restaurant for a decade and just recently sold it. She was wondering what was next. Meanwhile, Carter's research led him from the Revolutionary War in the Northeast all the way down to the Kanawha Valley. The common thread? Salt.
I one day asked Carter if the family stopped making salt because there was no more brine, and he said, no, there's plenty of brine. So then there was the aha moment of, well, we need to be making salt again.
Again, that was Nancy Bruns, co-owner of J.Q. Dickinson Salt here in West Virginia. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to hear what Nancy and her brother find when they start making salt again, and how they're trying to transform an industry that once depended on coal to one that runs on nothing but the sun. That's ahead. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt, white sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Yeah, in the daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Hello, I'm Bill Holt from Wheeling, and I want to tell you a love story. A love for West Virginia Public Radio, that is. My love affair with West Virginia Public Radio started when I was a teenager. I especially enjoyed Garrison on Saturday evenings and Terry Gross on Fresh Air, as well as listening to the day's roundup on All Things Considered. This love of national programming seamlessly transferred to homegrown programs, especially when hearing Andy Ridenour introduce Larry Gross singing Mountain Stage's intro, A Simple Song. Fast forward to today, and you will find that I still love all of those programs, but have an even deeper love for A Change of Tune with Joni Deutsch and Inside Appalachia with Jessica Lilly. Why are these my new favorites? They are West Virginia programs produced by two wonderful West Virginia women. So if you love West Virginia Public Radio as much as I, order a box of Hall's Chocolate for someone special and show your love for West Virginia Public Broadcasting at the same time. Call 1-800-RADIO-87 or go to the website wvpublic.org.
We cannot tell Appalachia's story without the support of our listeners, without you. For 20 years, West Virginia Public Broadcasting has partnered with Hall's, a West Virginia family-owned business, for our Chocolate Challenge Fund Drive. Because you support what we do, consider becoming a sustaining member of West Virginia Public Broadcasting now. When you do, you can have a box of Hall's chocolates, made in the Swiss tradition, sent to someone in time for Valentine's Day. Call 1-800-RADIO-87 or go to wvpublic.org and be sure to tell them how much you love Inside Appalachia, and thank you. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry, Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. Today on our show, we're hearing stories about food from Appalachia. Now, back to Caleb Johnson and J.Q. Dickinson Saltworks.
After Nancy learned that there was still brine beneath the Kanawha Valley in West Virginia, she called her brother Lewis. He was managing some of the family's natural resource assets at the time and had been toying with other food-related business ventures. And this idea sounded like a good one to him. The siblings pored over old Dickinson Saltworks survey maps, consulted an engineering firm, and eventually they drilled into the earth almost exactly where one of their ancestors' 9 wells once operated.
The driller we were using is used to drilling for fresh water, so when he hit fresh water, he thought his job was done, but it was just getting started, so I don't think he had done this very often.
The process took 2 weeks instead of the typical 3 or 4 days.
We went through at least 2 drill bits that I know of. The sandstone tends to get pretty hard through this area.
We kept tasting the water to see if it was salty and see if it was salty.
Finally, the drill struck brine around 300 feet.
I remember specifically when they hit the salt water and there was this huge plume. It's like striking oil or something, and we put our cups under the water to taste it, and it was salty. I remember just feeling a sigh of relief. Okay, we got it.
Today, Nancy says their well is the only one used in making edible salt in the Kanawha Valley. But installing a working well turned out to be the easy part.
We knew we could make salt if we got salty water, because just by the sheer nature of it, but we didn't know what that salt would taste like. And we knew, Stein knew in my mind, that modern palates are very different than they were in the 19th century. And there were some other moments where we tasted it. It's like, oh gosh, that is just not that good. Or I'd try and do some experiments at home and the kids would taste it. I'm like, oh gosh, that's disgusting, Mom. This is never going to work.
Nancy and Lewis knew there were trace minerals in the brine affecting the salt's flavor. they experimented with different ways of refining the salt. For example, they let the brine set in a tank longer so the iron would fall out. It was a learning process.
Well, I can remember it so vividly, that taste, when we got it right, and it just, I mean, it just gave me chills thinking about it. It was like, wow, that is so good. And you just don't think about a salt being just overwhelmingly good, but when you've tasted a zillion of them and then you get this one flavor and you're like, oh my gosh, wow, we've really got a product here.
Lewis leads me into a room where the salt is eventually sifted, cleaned, packaged, and mailed to a growing list of restaurants and homes. I wanted to have a taste of it for myself. He warms up some caramel Nancy made to cut the salt with a little sweet.
You need to let that cool for a minute.
Lewis sprinkles on some finishing salt and then hands me a miniature popsicle stick with a dollop of caramel stuck on the end. The big crystals cause the salt to linger on my tongue longer than I'm used to. But there's no bitterness, no burn. It's almost refreshing.
I'm gonna try one more. So good.
Before going to market, Nancy and Lewis asked several chefs to taste their salt. One of them was Sean Brock. Sean is from rural Virginia. He's known for highlighting southern ingredients in his restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina, and Nashville. He now uses J.Q. Dickinson salt in all his kitchens. I gave him a call. Sean was in Atlanta cooking a dinner to benefit farmers and getting the word out about a restaurant he's opening there.
Hello.
Hey, Sean. It's Caleb Johnson.
How you doing, man?
Sean said he had a hard time finding salt made in the South that also tasted the way he wanted. For a time, he even made salt in-house using brine a fisherman brought in from off the coast of Charleston. But that stopped when he tasted the stuff Nancy and Lewis sent him.
Once I tasted that salt and heard the story, I immediately called and asked if I could buy everything. And I actually wasn't joking. I called and said, how much salt can you guys produce and how much can I buy? Like, I was like, I want truckloads of it.
Sean says he loved how clean the salt tasted, but it wasn't just the taste. Sean sees J.Q. Dickinson salt as part of a reawakening in Southern food.
I think the South is going through an incredible phase right now where the cuisine and the culture is really sort of being reborn again. This stuff has always existed. We just kind of forgot about it for a little while. And now we're all starting to realize that we have it all. We have everything. We have everything we could ask for. And that makes being a cook so much easier. And it makes being a diner and a consumer so much more fun.
Back in Malden, history presses up against itself like the geologic layers stacked underfoot. Down by the river, coal barges float past the rambling white house where some Dickinson cousins live part-time. Within a rock's throw, Lewis points out a crumbling tower he says is part of the original Saltworks boiler system.
As far as I can tell, this is one of the last standing signs of the industry in general.
Even standing in front of this relic, it's difficult imagining the pastures where cows now graze and the shady riverbank were once a sprawling industrial site. Nancy and Lewis have started cleaning up around the boiler and the accompanying railroad tracks leading to nowhere. They placed historical markers elsewhere on the property too, but most of their preservation efforts have been focused on the old family offices, a white wooden building near some barns set along a two-track road that splits vegetable gardens and pastures. The offices date to near the turn of the previous century. They were semi-active until the 1980s, but at first glance, you might wonder if the place has been locked up for 100 years. A photo of John Q. Dickinson hangs on the wall. He's the namesake of the company and Nancy and Lewis's great-great-grandfather.
On another wall, you'll see a blue map that's got the old well logs on it that helped us determine where and how deep we should be drilling.
Ledgers from the 1800s lie open on a slanted wooden desk.
Looks like they're buying supplies here, so they're coffee for $35 and molasses for $50, pepper, sugar. A lot of these things they were buying to store in the company store where the workers would come and buy things.
A stencil that reads Soul Makers of Kanawha Salt stands on a shelf. It was once used to mark wooden barrels. Next to the stencil stand five tea-colored bottles with Kanawha Salt still in them.
this one. It says Sunday salt. It says extra coarse, made for Butcher's Hide Association. It takes bottles like these to see where somebody has handwritten on a label. You know, that's really how it comes to your mind's eye. It's reassuring in some ways, just the connection to history and family. And it's fascinating just to see it. It's almost, you almost don't believe it.
Seeing and touching these artifacts in such a serene setting, it's easy to get caught up and forget just how destructive industry was here. The air in Malden was once black with smoke, and many salt works used the river as a dump. And drilling for salt brine gave way to coal and natural gas operations in the region, which meant new jobs, but also meant more pollution. The Dickinson family expanded into these businesses too, and still leases out land for coal and natural gas extraction. This has been a boon for the family over the years, but the environmental impact doesn't always sit easy with Nancy.
It is a bit of a conflict in my mind. We're playing both sides of the coin a bit, I would say. You know, I haven't cut myself off from my family for doing that, and I don't plan on it. It's something that I think is, important for the state as well as, you know, for the country moving forward. We still rely on these resources and have relied on them for many years, and it really built this country. So, it's something that I wrestle with a bit, but, I think that's also a healthy thing to be aware of, choices that are in my control and, what my ancestors done in the past.
And that awareness led Nancy and Lewis to do things differently. For one, their operation is much smaller than the Kanawha Salt Works of the 1800s. Their salt-making process depends solely on the sun's energy instead of burning coal and timber. That might mean fewer jobs. For now, 3 paid positions, not counting Nancy and Lewis. But it also means less impact on the environment.
We definitely think of our salt as a product of Mother Nature, something that comes from the ground, that the sun and breezes are bringing it to fruition. And when it's ripe, in quotes there, then we harvest it. Our salt gives you that expression of the West Virginia earth here in the Appalachian Mountains.
This may sound like a break from how the Dickinson family used to do things, but Nancy says keeping the land productive for future generations has always been a family value, even if that might seem like a contradiction. Nancy and Lewis both have kids who already take an interest in this revived family business. Meanwhile, the region is reaching a kind of crossroads.
West Virginia's in a huge transition right now because of the depression of the coal industry. And so what's going to happen in this state? And so while we're having very little impact, we're just one very small example of what can happen.
Nobody can say what Malden will look like 10, 20, 100 years from now. But if there are any Dickinson descendants still around, it's a good bet they'll still be making salt.
Caleb Johnson is a writer based in Pittsburgh. He produced this story with Irina Zhurov, a writer and reporter who also lives in Pittsburgh. This story was part of a recent episode of a podcast called Gravy, which is produced by the Southern Foodways Alliance. The show's host is Tina Antolini. She's based out of New Orleans. I'm Jessica Lilly. This is Inside Appalachia. Today on our show, we're talking about the traditional Southern foods that are being revived by chefs across the country. When we come back, we're going to travel to a fried chicken festival in Virginia, and we'll be hearing the story about the history of fried chicken among African American communities in the South.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about food and some of the food we Southern Appalachians are kind of famous for. Next, we're going to explore something that's easy for many of us to love. Fried chicken. I mean, If there ever were a comfort food that most people think of as an emblem to the South, this is it. Dunked in buttermilk, shaken in a brown paper bag with flour and seasonings, and dropped into hot oil. My grandmother made the best. But there's a flip side to the fried goodness of this comfort food. Fried chicken has both been the vehicle for the economic empowerment of a whole group of people and the accessory to an ugly racial stereotype. How can something so delicious be both? Again, we're hearing from our friends over at the Southern Foodways Alliance from their podcast, Gravy. From just outside of Appalachia in central Virginia, Lauren Ober brings us this story, which ponders how a dish can embody such contrasts, both empowerment and discrimination.
It's a scorching afternoon at the Gordonsville, Virginia Fairgrounds. The teenage cloggers on the stage look a little listless as they hoof it in the heat. And the homemade ice cream vendor has no trouble selling his product. Inside Vincent Seal's mobile kitchen, it's easily 10 degrees hotter. That's not just because it's a steel box on wheels. It's mainly because Seal's wife, Stephanie Terrell, has been frying up her chicken since early that morning. Seal is sweating and is covered in batter. It's on his apron, it's wringing his neck. I even spot some flecks of it in his eyebrows.
This is a secret recipe here. It's a dry batter.
Seal tells me that means there's no egg wash and no buttermilk, which might sound unusual to some fried chicken connoisseurs, but it's traditional here in Gordonsville.
We take the chicken straight out of the pack, batter it, put it in the fryer.
Okay.
We put all our secret spices. As you see, I think people are enjoying it.
Yeah, you got a line.
That's a good thing.
Seal and Terrell are competing in the annual Gordonsville Fried Chicken Festival's Fried Chicken Cook-Off. Terrell's closely guarded recipe won the competition the past 2 years, and they have every intention of making this year a three-peat. Their main rival? A well-oiled machine called the Barbecue Exchange. They're a restaurant and catering outfit in Gordonsville that focuses on pig, but a few times a year they pull out the deep-fat fryer and fry up some fowl. I try to get the scoop from manager Todd Grieger.
So what is the secret to this particular fried chicken?
There's two secrets. The first secret is making sure that it's cooked, and the second secret is not telling other people your secrets.
Come on, give me a little something.
Pork lard and good-looking men.
There you go.
Pork lard and good-looking men, that's all?
That's better, right?
About okay, it,
yeah.
That's good.
Stephanie Terrell might not entirely agree with that assessment. She's part of the town's vibrant African-American community and has been frying chicken since she was 12. Her mother cooked for years at a boarding school in the area and taught her daughter how to make all the staples. In a way, Terrell's iteration is an homage to her mother and the honored place fried chicken had at their family table.
We used to have it every Sunday meal, fried chicken, string beans, macaroni and cheese. That was every Sunday meal. I just like chicken. It's my favorite.
Seal knew his wife had the cooking chops to enter the Fried Chicken Festival cook-off. Plus, as longtime residents of Gordonsville, they felt like they might have a special advantage.
Stephanie has always cooked, and Gordonsville has a heritage of, you know, chicken history. So we just thought that'd be a good thing for us to do, and we beat around the bushes and found some good recipes here from Gordonsville, some of the elders, you know, and it's worked out.
So it's not just that Stephanie Terrell is a good home cook. It's that she comes from a long line of Gordonsville women who made fried chicken for a living. During the Civil War, the town of Gordonsville was jumping. Its current mayor, Bob Coyner, says at the time, the town was a main stop on two train lines, the East-West Virginia Central and the North-South Orange and Alexandria. And it had three new turnpikes, making it a regional transportation hub.
So all the produce in the western part of Virginia came on the turnpikes by wagon to Gordonsville to get on the trains to then go to eastern ports and cities and whatnot. So it was very important.
Now, imagine that the Civil War has just ended and you're on a packed train that's rumbling through central Virginia. It's sticky and hot and the windows are down to let in some air. Your stomach is grumbling and the trains don't yet have dining cars. You approach the Gordonsville station on your way to Charlottesville or Richmond and a good smell hits you square in the nose. It's the unmistakable aroma of fried chicken. You look out the window and you see half a dozen black women, some with platters on their heads, rushing the train windows. On the platters are fried fruit pies, hot coffee, and of course that fried chicken you smelled earlier. They hold up their platters to the open train windows so passengers can grab some food. You hand down some money and then snag a golden brown leg. It's perfect. Crispy on the outside, juicy on the inside. You also grab a fried pie for dessert and a coffee to wash it all down. Then the train whistle blows, the women step back off the platform, and you're headed to the next stop. These women were the waiter carriers.
This is what they call themselves.
That's Psyche Williams-Forson. She's a professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland.
They found themselves both as the sort of modern-day waiter, right? But then they also carried these foods, right? Some distance, probably.
Williams-Forson is the author of Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs, Black Women, Food, and Power. The title of her book comes from an article written by a third-generation waiter carrier who explained that her mother had built her house out of chicken legs, or rather that these women used food, and fried chicken in particular, as a way to make a living for themselves and their families. Mayor Coyner, whose family goes back many generations in Gordonsville, says that degree of financial independence was rare post-emancipation.
At the end of the Civil War, when we've got new freedoms for people, they're put in a position where suddenly they need jobs. You know, the situation was bad before, but you could count on the situation. And that was a big unknown. So, you know, the ladies, these entrepreneurs that did this wonderful cooking and raised money for their families and built homes, they have such admiration. It's not just talking about how great the chicken was and how great the food was. They're so admired for their courage and their entrepreneurship. It was really a remarkable story.
The waiter carrier's earning potential was only restricted by their platter capacity. As much as they could make and carry, they could sell. Unlike many of their husbands who worked on farms, their wages weren't fixed. For her book, Professor Williams-Forson combed through old newspaper articles and other historical documents to find detailed histories of these women. But it was tough. There just aren't many records left that illustrate what these women's lives were like.
The question becomes, how many trains did they serve during a day? What time did they have to get there? And what time did they leave? How far did they come? How did they keep the foods, you know, warm? The coffee was steaming hot. You almost have your modern day food truck in these women.
But what is known is that the waiter carriers and their fried chicken were sought after.
Some people deliberately would chart their way through Gordonsville because they knew that they would encounter these women and those particular foodstuffs.
After the Civil War, Northern journalists traveled the South by train on goodwill tours. They documented their trip through Gordonsville in an 1873 book called The Pine and the Palm Meeting. Here's how they describe their visit to the town.
Upon the arrival of our special train, we were surrounded with a swarm of old and young Negroes of both sexes carrying large servers upon their heads containing pies, cakes, chickens, boiled eggs, strawberries and cream, ripe cherries, oranges, tea and coffee, biscuit, sandwiches, fried ham and eggs, and other edibles, which they offered for sale.
Years later, another journalist from a Richmond newspaper praised the fried chicken, writing, "There was never such a place as Gordonsville. There were never better cooks. It is a fact that nowhere else on earth is chicken fried as it is here. It is an art."
Each time they would come through Gordonsville, because Gordonsville is kind of a central railroad hub, they just went on and on about these ladies and the food in Gordonsville.
The Gordonsville waiter carriers weren't the only Black women who created homegrown business opportunities for themselves. Williams-Forson found evidence that before and after the Civil War and emancipation, Black women would sell produce and meat in local marketplaces. Some of these women used the proceeds to buy their own freedom. It's mind-boggling to think about now, given what we know or think we know about slavery and its devastating effects, that enslaved women were able to finance their own purchase by selling food they made. Or, in the case of waiter carriers, whose heyday came after the Civil War, that free women could support their families on the skills that they had honed while in bondage.
I think it's important to talk about it because it reflects some level of agency that some African Americans were able to exhibit during that horrible institution.
The waiter carriers in Gordonsville continued selling fried chicken to incoming trains until the 1920s or 30s. No one's exactly sure when they quit. But their disappearance was a result of a number of factors. The main one? Air conditioning. AC on the train meant that the windows stayed shut, and the women couldn't sell their chicken if they couldn't get to the passengers. Plus, trains began to have their own dining cars, and increased regulation of restaurants and food vendors meant that health inspectors were on the prowl, and they were known to hassle the women on the platform. But the decline of the waiter carrier isn't the end of the story. Some of those women used their profits to start their own restaurants or catering businesses. And they were in good company. There's a long legacy of Black women using food as a way to get ahead.
We've been listening to a story about fried chicken produced by Lauren Ober and the Southern Foodways Alliance. For the final part of our show today, we're going to hear the rest of Lauren Ober's story about the relationship many African Americans have with cooking fried chicken. Next, for a twist on this Southern food story, Lauren takes us up to Harlem in New York to introduce us to one African American woman who owns her own fried chicken restaurant.
Melba Wilson is totally larger than life. When I told the 40-something owner of Melba's restaurant in Harlem that I was producing a story for a podcast called Gravy, this was her response.
I love gravy. I make smothered pork chops with gravy. I also make smothered chicken with gravy.
In case it wasn't obvious, Wilson is really into food.
Food and I, we're lovers. You know, it's a very personal relationship with food.
One type of food that Wilson is very intimate with is what some would call soul food. She's staked her career on it. The signature dish on her menu is fried chicken and eggnog waffles. Like Stephanie Terrell in Gordonsville, she comes from a family of talented cooks. Wilson is the niece of the late Sylvia Woods, the soul food magnate whose eponymous restaurant is a short walk from Melba's in New York. Woods was originally from the PD region of South Carolina and moved north to open a restaurant catering to the Southern Blacks who had landed in Harlem as a part of the Great Migration. By the 1920s, more than 200,000 Black people lived in Harlem. Before the Great Migration, it was a predominantly white neighborhood. It was Woods who gave Wilson her first restaurant job.
You know, I was the hostess, I was the assistant catering director, I was the cashier. I pretty much did whatever my aunt needed done. If she asked me to do it, you did it. And that's how it was in the South, you know. They came up from the old South. So when they told you to do something, you said, yes, ma'am, and you did it.
Wilson worked for her aunt for 11 years before striking out on her own. Her restaurant is less explicitly soul food. While Sylvia's menu features Southern classics like oxtails, chitlins, and barbecue ribs, Melba's offerings tend to depart from traditional preparations. Wine-braised short ribs, barbecue turkey meatloaf, and three-cheese mac and cheese. Still, Melba says she tries to honor her Southern roots.
It's food that was originally slave food. You know, the collard greens were the bitterest of the greens. The ribs were parts of the meat that people didn't want. The grits was food that would hold you over while you were working on the plantation. But it's also food that evokes warm memories.
Sometimes, though, the emotions Southern food evokes aren't based on memories. Instead, they reference nostalgia for a romanticized South, a mythologized South where life moved at a slower pace and modernity hadn't yet crept in and all Black women could cook. Professor Psyche Williams-Forson says this is problematic because this thinking reinforces stereotypical images of what Southern food is and who makes it.
People do what they're good at and also what the public expects of them, because food is so powerful in its marking of things and messages and in its coding of messages that we tend to associate certain people with certain foods.
Black women get associated with soul food.
A Black woman frying chicken any day of the week is going to garner more money, if there's money to be made, than a non-African-American woman cooking chicken because of the idea that she knows how to cook better.
All that was useful for the waiter carriers 100 plus years ago. They were businesswomen selling a product, and it's useful for Melba Wilson today. Those stories and that food have helped put money in their pockets. With proceeds, they have supported themselves and their families. And in a country where African Americans have historically been denied economic opportunities, earning your own living is no small feat. But most food, and fried chicken in particular, comes with coded messages. Fried chicken and watermelon are consumed by everyone. But if I eat it as a white person, it doesn't say much about me. If a black person eats it, it can telegraph something else.
Here's this food that is, first of all, eaten with the hands, right? And so right away, there's this notion of savagery, of less than refinement, and so forth. And so if we can continue over time to literally associate black people or any group of people with this thing, then they can become that thing in some ways, right? And so over and over, it gets reinforced, and so it becomes naturalized. Why is that a negative? Because now it's like, look at these barbarians, you know.
Williams Forson says that's the reason why many African American men won't eat fried chicken in public. That's also the reason MSNBC host Melissa Harris-Perry won't allow watermelon in her green room fruit platter. It's not because those foods aren't appetizing, it's the optics of eating them. Southern food is rich in racial paradoxes. During the Jim Crow era, many white families employed black cooks who fried chicken for family dinners. Often those black cooks slept in white homes. But in public, whites wouldn't share a water fountain with blacks. In private, though, they'd happily eat the food they made.
These women are in a subservient role. They're in the service industry, right? Just like today, we tend very rarely to think about the people who are serving us in our upscale or regular scale restaurants. We give no credence, really, or thought to who's in the back of the house.
Like Psyche Williams-Forson, Karen Cox has spent a lot of time thinking about these intersections and complications. She's a history professor at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and the author of Dreaming of Dixie, How the South Was Created in American Popular Culture. The book is an examination of how the South has been packaged over the years to sell to the North and beyond.
All these different industries that were shaping a narrative and an image of the American South that really drew my interest. It isn't that Southerners didn't also have an interest in shaping an image of the Old South as a mythology. Things like the Southern Belle and the Cavalier Gentleman and, you know, antebellum mansions with the white columns and the mammies and, you know, faithful slaves and all of that. So that was certainly part of, you know, the lost cause narrative among Southerners. But what was interesting to me was, why was it that these Northern industries were also playing up that narrative to sell products?
The most recognizable Southern image used to sell products up north and around the country? Aunt Jemima. Cox explains that this non-threatening, asexual mammy figure in a headscarf and an apron wasn't born in a tumble-down cabin on a Louisiana plantation. She was manufactured on Madison Avenue.
Have you got a temptilating, tantalizing old plantation thing for us today, Aunt Jemima?
Yes, sir, one that's specially good these days. It's that folks who smiles at breakfast mostly don't never need no doctor.
This idea of a black population that was subservient or seemed to be content in the role of that, I think, was attractive. It's why Aunt Jemima was popular. You know, so there's been commentary, you know, by whites in the North that somehow that Southern blacks are the better blacks because they know how to be deferential.
Aunt Jemima became an aspirational symbol for white consumers. If you had money, you could afford to hire a domestic to do the cooking for you. And Aunt Jemima seems so damn happy to be in service that any guilt a white person might have felt was quickly melted by her toothy ear-to-ear smile. Cox has a million examples of how the South was prettied up to sell, and not all of them are historical. They're still happening now. Glory Foods is a company that makes canned Southern food. It was founded by one of the first black graduates of the Culinary Institute of America, though in 2010 it was sold to a white-owned family business. A couple of years ago, they ran this ad in television markets in the South.
I don't want to eat my vegetables. I don't want to. I don't want to. I don't want to. Yeah. Yuck.
Uh-uh. Stop all this drama for your mama. You need some flavor. You need some glory in your life.
Then the African-American woman pops open a family-sized can of string beans, dumps them in a saucepan, and gets to stirring. The kids shut up, the white lady is happy, and dinner is saved.
Much better.
It was awful. I just couldn't believe that they thought that that would fly. Yeah, so that's like this modern, I mean, super recent take on using black women. It was like, did you all see The Help and then decide to do this?
Cox wrote about this on her blog, Pop South. She says shortly after her blog post went up, and after she reached out to the agency that made the commercials, the ads were taken down from YouTube. It seems like everyone is hawking some version of the South, whether it's the memory of certain comfort foods or the nostalgia of servitude and domesticity. The South is still a commodity to be marketed and sold. But here's the thing. For folks like Melba Wilson, who make their living off of food, that's just fine. There's not a whole lot of fussing over whether there's anything wrong with selling the food you're good at making. I asked her whether she might be advancing a caricature of black women by cooking the food that she does.
There was never a consideration that I might be playing into a stereotype in making American comfort food. What I wanted to do was to show that we can all come together and enjoy our food together. Because ultimately, it's about bridging gaps.
Lots of academically grounded discussions focus on fried chicken and the folks who make it. But one thing that can't be denied is the sense of pride and purpose that people, and in this case, black women, have in the food they make. Stereotypes be damned.
Lauren Ober is a reporter at WAMU in Washington, D.C. You can find more information about this story on our website, including a link to Syke Forsen's book, Building Houses Out of Chicken Bones, Black Women, Food, and Power, and to Karen Cox's book, Dreaming of Dixie, How the South Was Created in American Popular Culture. They're at wbpublic.org. We've also posted links to where you can learn more about the Southern Foodways Alliance and their Gravy podcast, the groups that produced the stories you heard today on Inside Appalachia. So I really have gravy and biscuits for breakfast. My kids don't eat it, and my husband is on a kale and fruit smoothie kick, and he usually shares his chunky yet delicious drink with me. But this weekend, I made sausage gravy. A lot of sausage gravy. Along with my kale smoothie, I've ironically had biscuits and gravy almost every morning this week. Music in today's show was provided by Larry Gross, Hell for Certain String Band, Blue Dot Sessions, and David Shulman in the Quiet Life Motel, Ryan Little, Digital Primitives, and Diagram Collective. Our theme music is by Ben Townsend and Andy Agnew Jr. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.